Hello there, this is Russell T. Davis, and welcome to Doctor Who on Target. Enjoy!
Welcome to Doctor Who on Target. Podcast where we discuss the target range of classic Doctor Who novelisations from the 1970s and 80s, those long ago days where, if you missed Doctor Who on TV, you missed it forever. Unless, of course, you bought the target novelisation. So, join us, jump aboard the TARDIS, set the time rotor for late 20th century Earth, and, with a wheezing, groaning sound, we'll discuss Doctor Who on Target. Hello, this is Greg in Swansea.
And this is David in Chelmsford.
And welcome to Doctor Who on Target. And today, what are we looking at, David?
Well, we're looking at The Pirate Planet by James Goss from the original story by Douglas Adams.
Now, we've actually been a little bit behind in getting this one done, which has been entirely my fault. So you might hear a little bit of a hesitation in this review because poor David's going to have to try and prompt yourself, David, isn't it? Because you listened to it. It was a little while ago now, but I'm afraid I'm being behind. I've been slow catching up with it. But one thing which struck me, Doctor Who, The Pirate Planet, Tom Baker, Douglas Adams, that name is just, is such a renowned name in the world of science fiction. But it's not often equated with Doctor Who in the public eye, I think, is it?
No.
What could you tell us a little bit what the link is with Douglas Adams?
Douglas Adams, he was most famous for his Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books, wasn't he? For the radio show that they spawned. But while he was in the process of making that, he had a little job. I think he submitted a script for Doctor Who, didn't he?
He did. Yeah.
And the current script editor, Anthony Reed, saw huge potential in him.
Yeah.
And I believe that eventually he was offered the script editor's job full time, which he did, I think, for a season. Was it more than a season?
I think it was just over a season.
He had a fairly short tenure on the show, but then became incredibly successful as an author. And had his when would the Hitchhiker's Guide television series? I guess that came out in about 1980-81.
It was, isn't it?
Could be wrong.
I think it's slightly
after Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And I guess he never looked back because he had his Dirk Gently books as well, didn't he? As well as his Hitchhiker's Guide.
I liked the Dirk Gently books, yeah.
Dirk Gently, which has been made into a television programme in this country with, I can't even remember the names. Stephen Magnum, wasn't he?
And he's very Dirk good Gently. In it too. Yeah.
And then recently, and I haven't seen it, there was an American version of it as well.
I haven't seen that.
So I don't know if that one had legs, but definitely enjoyed. It was Darren Boyd, wasn't it? Was the other person in the
UK
version of Dirk Gently. But they only made less than a handful of these shows, which was a shame. I did enjoy them. And of course, Dirk Gently was based upon Sharda as well. It was at that time, the Sharda script was unusable, and Douglas Adams fashioned it into a new story, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
Well, do you know, this leads me on to a little bit of because when I was saying that Douglas Adams isn't really associated with Doctor Who, it's only people, you're sort of in the know, the real fans, I suppose, like us, who used to really know that his connection with Doctor Who. But I remember buying, because The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was, it's one of those ones which you could describe as a phenomenon. You know, it was genuinely huge, wasn't it? You know, it was so successful. But I remember buying Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency and the Dark Tea Time of the Soul. I think it was. I think that was. I remember reading it and thinking, God, this is almost exactly the same as that lost Doctor Who story.
Yes, that was no coincidence.
Well, this was it.
I suppose it's wonderfully pragmatic, though, when you've written something and that falls through. And I mean, a lot of writing, some writing evolves from what's gone before it, doesn't it?
Yes,
Shakespeare didn't write an original plot in all but two cases.
And the two cases... The two cases which
The Tempest and the other one I can't remember, possibly The Merry Wives of Windsor.
Oh, is it The Merry Wives of Windsor, the other one?
Those could have been his original plots. I know The Tempest is definitely one of his original plots.
The Tempest is definitely one of my favourites.
Everything else is sourced from historical material, isn't it? Or things that have gone before.
Absolutely,
It's wonderfully pragmatic to reuse. If you've got a good plot... there are a certain number of plots that exist in the universe anyway, so...
Yeah. Some of the Russian philosophers say there's 12, aren't there, or something like that. I don't know.
I don't know how many plots there are, but there's a very special plot about the benign stranger who comes into the community and makes things better, and that's the one that Doctor Who has exploited wonderfully for all these years.
Oh, that's really interesting. I wasn't aware of that.
Everything reacts against what goes before it.
Yeah.
But I think I should throw in here that I did actually meet Douglas Adams.
Oh, yeah. No, jealous. How do you spell jealousy? Because this is really...
We had the briefest of conversations. It was at a book signing.
Yeah.
I've still got the book signed. It's somewhere at home.
You've got a signed copy.
I can't even tell you which one of the Hitchhiker's books it is. Probably the last one. But we had a brief conversation which went along the lines of, I pointed out to him that he was left-handed, which he probably already well knew. And I said, that's a coincidence. I'm left-handed.
Right.
And he said, we should have our own club. But we won't let George Bush Senior in because he doesn't strike me as a proper lefty.
Ah, really? Wow.
That was the total depth of our exchange. George, he probably didn't call him George Bush Senior, but not J.W. Herbert.
Right.
Is it Herbert?
Yeah. George Herbert, I think is.
The ailing elderly American president.
Yeah, yeah.
He couldn't come in our special left-handers club. Douglas Adams decreed it.
Gosh.
But I've noticed actually he was also looking at his Wikipedia page, and I think we all know the internet's the source of all good information and it's invariably true.
Yeah.
I'm reading here on Douglas Adams' Wikipedia page on the internet, the source of all knowledge invariably true, that he was educated privately, locally to where I am now, at a place called Brentwood School.
Right.
Which had alumni including Robin Day, Jack Straw, Noel Edmonds and Griff Rhys-Jones.
Good gosh.
Funny enough, I've been past Brentwood School today.
Right.
Yes, I've been running Brentwood today. It was the Brentwood half today.
Oh.
So there you go. That's so on those very roads the great man might have trodden. You never know.
So he went from there to Cambridge, I believe, wasn't it?
He did go to Cambridge and I can also see from his Wikipedia that he had a very small appearance in Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Did he?
Or was it Monty Python? No, he had several by the looks of things.
Good God.
You know that Monty Python sort of comes out of Oxbridge, doesn't it?
With
half of them being Oxford and the other half being Cambridge.
I wasn't aware of that. So it's half Oxford and half Cambridge.
I think Eric Idle is Oxford and maybe one of the other ones as well.
Right.
And John Cleese is most definitely Cambridge.
Oh. Yes.
Who was working with who? I don't know if Terry Jones and Michael Palin would have gone to the same university. I don't know which one it was, but it will be one of the two, which suggests that Graham Chapman was also at Cambridge.
Oh.
But it was like, you know, I say half and half because Cambridge also had people who ended up in the goodies. Bill Oddie was there at the same time as well.
Yes, yes, that's right.
There we go. Yes, you're right, Douglas Adams did go to Cambridge, and of course Sharda is set in Cambridge.
Yeah.
A lot of location filming in Cambridge.
Yeah, some beautiful location filming, actually, wasn't it? Which it's a pity we never got to see that finished episode, but... Pulling us back to the Pirate Planet.
Oh, yes.
Where we go, it's the Douglas Adams name, isn't it? It's just dragging us away from it.
I'm afraid it is.
But let's see what's happened now. He made the Pirate Planet, or he wrote the Pirate Planet. It was made. It's one you can buy on DVD. Mm-hmm. It's a great story. But the actual Target version never materialised.
No, it didn't.
And that, I believe, you correct me if I'm wrong here, David, but I think it was because the name of Douglas Adams, again, was so huge that the money couldn't cover it, I think, wasn't it? So
I'm not sure. I think possibly there could have been... I suppose it could have been farmed out to another writer, but perhaps he didn't wish that to happen. And, of course, the irony there would be that he was far too busy himself to actually deal with it.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's probably why it got left. It wasn't reallocated to another author.
Yes.
And he just didn't have the time himself.
Yes, yeah.
Because of course, it was a big gap along with City of Death.
Yeah, yes, of course. Now, City of Death, which we haven't reviewed as yet, but we'll do that because soon we'll get hold of that, some copies of that, and review that, I think. But right. This one, The Pirate Planet, now has been completed by James Goss.
James Goss.
Now, he's written quite a few Doctor Who. I think he's been involved in Big Finish as well. And is that
has
right?
Has he?
I think so.
I know he wrote the novel of City of Death because it was... Oh, dear. He didn't do the Sharda one. That was Gareth... Oh, I can't remember.
Gareth Jones, wasn't it? No.
No, he's the chap who wrote... He writes for New Who, the chap who wrote the... I'm terrible, I can't remember any of their names.
Don't worry.
We'll have to come back to that, yes. But I think the point I'm making is the emergence of those three books added to the Target novel sort of completes the Fourth Doctor's era.
Yes.
And this was the final piece of the jigsaw.
And which was very...
That's a good thing, and... James Goss, well, we're going to have to discuss his writing, aren't we, eventually?
Well, we are.
I think the first point to make about it, and we should make the listeners aware, is that the story now runs over 10 CDs.
It's incredible.
And so it does lack the pace of a traditional Target novel.
Oh, this is no Terence Dix story.
Concise Terence Dix prose isn't there. In fact, I would say,
and
I think we've spoken about this privately, but I did warn you that it doesn't become sort of a bit more urgent and gripping till about CD5 because there's a lot of time invested in setting down the plot, which would look totally out of place in a traditional Target novel.
Oh, absolutely, it would. completely. And I think, you know, we're looking at that. I mean, I'm looking at the lovely package from BBC Audio here, which is, as you say, it's 10 discs.
10 discs.
And 11 hours and 15 minutes runtime.
Yes.
It's a long, big... So now, there's no abridgment in this at all, is it?
No, and that's a very good thing, isn't it?
It is.
It's good that somebody has taken the time and the trouble to absolutely go back and include all of the source material that they can lay their hands on.
Yes.
In order to give us the fullest possible... novelization, but I think it does come as a shock to the system for traditional target listeners because as I say it takes a while to become urgent and gripping.
Well, this is it, and it's interesting you said that you did warn me because it the warning, you know, was not without foundation because
I don't want to start off on a negative thing about it, but
no.
I agree with you completely. Is that aside from the you know, some interesting opening, because of course we have you know, the sort of banter in the TARDIS between Romana and the Doctor, but after that there is quite an awful long period of, I think you called it, the domestic stuff.
Yes, there are a lot of domestic scenes in it.
Yeah, and
sets up the family unit and the dynamic.
Yeah,
in that family, and it does it several times without advancing the plot.
It does,
particularly because you've got the pessimist, you've got the grandfather, Balaton, who always thinks the sky is going to fall in on his head.
Yeah,
he's the one who draws the curtains whilst Prelix is having a fit.
Yeah,
because he doesn't want the guards coming, and he's the one who was complicit in the guards killing Prelix's father.
Right,
as well, wasn't he? Because he thinks that the mourners carry the disease; they carry guilt.
Yes,
don't they?
Which we'll get onto that in a second, because that isn't it. But
that's an interesting strand, so we'll save that for a moment. But
yeah.
I did think that John Coleshaw was doing an excellent job portraying these scenes, but they didn't tell us, you know, we got very quickly that the granddad was a complicit warrior in what was going on, or that Prelix was stricken, that Mueller was a bit more ballsy than her friend Keymus, who was all mouth and no trousers. And we sort of got that several times, didn't we?
Several times. And I have
exchanges of those opening discs.
Yeah.
And it did take a while to really grip.
To be honest, to be honest, David, I felt, I mean, you just, even when you were mentioning their names then, Keymus and so, I tuned out when I was listening to it, you know.
Right.
I tuned out because it was getting, you know, when you have this sort of list-like element of names which aren't names,
right,
which you can easily remember, and characters,
right,
which are not, you know, centre stage characters, I think. Mm. I don't think they're the sort of characters that hold the stage. And they were given an awful lot of time in the first...
They were, and apparently James Goss had even more material that concerned them.
Really?
That was my understanding. But he, as I say, I mean, we must pay tribute to his commitment to giving us the fullest possible rendering of the story.
Yes.
We absolutely must pay tribute to that, because he did a fantastically thorough job.
Oh, absolutely.
The other character who had a lot of dialogue, the captain who exploded every line, he had quite a lot of cussing, didn't he?
Well,
and
it was
a very colourful character.
He's a fabulous...
I think he had even more sort of outbursts from the captain that, again, he didn't feel he could include in the book.
Did he really?
He felt it had sort of been covered.
Oh, no.
I don't want to substitute my judgment for him, you know, as to why he might have done that. But I guess, you know, I guess to out of a need to keep the story moving, really.
Well, that's a real pity, because
the captain is a fantastic character.
Oh, he's a great character. And I thought James Goss really captured the act.
I tell you something else. John Coleshaw's impression of him was spot on.
Do you know, I know we're going over, you know, we're mixing things up a bit here, but John Coleshaw is absolutely fabulous in this. I really cannot fault it. Everything he does is top-notch in it. Do you think so?
Oh, I do. I'm a big fan of his. As I said on the last podcast, I can't wait until he gets some more Target books to read. You know, I think he could do a great job with Revenge of the Cybermen, because he's got Doctor and Harry in there, who he does really well. And
does.
I know they've got a reader for Genesis of the Daleks that might not be him, but it's scheduled for release. I've got a feeling it might be Terry Malloy.
Oh, right.
We will wait and see who's announced. But
yes
he's you know, he does the captain so well. Obviously, he does the doctor.
It's a
really good canine.
Oh, he does, doesn't he? That it's a beautiful job of canine. I think he really captures the canine's.
I know we're zigzagging all over the place, but yeah. One of the things I really liked about what James Goss did was he actually gives canine several significant character moments.
Yeah,
and these are brilliantly played.
Yes.
Out on the audiobook. And I'm thinking the one that stands out is the fight when K-9 takes on the polyphase Avatron.
Yes, yeah.
And he sort of morphs into the Avenging Angel, doesn't he?
He does.
He becomes quite... He's not the trundle along dog we knew from the telly.
No,
I think that's a scene that's often criticised in the televised version because I think there's a theory out there that Pennant Roberts wasn't very good at directing action.
Ah, right.
That's true or not, because I haven't seen the show recently, but
yeah.
it's sort of a much maligned scene. But in this book, it's really, really good.
Yeah.
And it's read with pace, it's delivered with conviction. K-9's internal thought processes are explored.
Absolutely.
His need to bring the... Because he actually performs the kill off screen, doesn't he? And he sort of drops the bird at his master's feet.
It's a great
once
scene.
It's destroyed.
It? Yes, it's a
and I
great
thought, well,
scene.
He had another good scene where he had to flip himself out of a sort of an air car.
Yes.
And it goes through all his internal thought processes about how he's going to solve the problem, and he solves the problem, and he flips out of it.
It's great.
And then yeah. Able, because he thinks about the number of seconds he's got left to save Romana or whoever he's saving.
Yeah, yeah.
Goes, computes it all, and it's all wonderful stuff.
It is wonderful stuff.
This happens a little bit further into the audio.
Well, this is the thing, that the pieces I find that we are talking about with real enthusiasm are... the ones which don't involve those domestic scenes, I think, you know, because when James Goss is writing for, I say, the main characters, the Doctor, Romana, K-9, and the protagonists with the Captain and the Polyphase Avatar, all these, were, it's great stuff. It's really enjoyable. And having the icing on the cake of John Culshaw, beautifully reading it, beautifully getting the pacing just right. Everything's fab.
Yeah. And I think the character as well who is particularly good is Mr. Fibulee.
Oh, you had to bring him in. He's marked down.
He gets him spot on. And poor Mr. Fibulee, from his first appearance...
Yeah.
He's sort of expecting death on every page, isn't
yes,
he?
Yes, yes, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I won't say how he meets his doom and what is said at that time, because it's quite funny. But
it is. Yeah.
but he seems to live in this state of perpetual awareness that he's expendable.
Yes, yeah.
And it's so sad.
It's so sad.
He's got a sort of a semi-sadistic streak that he hasn't got on the telly, but I still felt for him.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. I don't know if the line was in the TV one, but it's right at the beginning when we first meet them, and it says, "The captain didn't kill him because secretly he rather liked his name, Mr.
Yes, it is. Yes, no, I remember that in the book. Yes.
But it's a lovely bit because it sort of gives the captain that little bit of a carrot and a sort of sense of... And he does, he's non-stop, Mr. Fibulee! And you can tell he's enjoying shouting at him, isn't he?
Yes, he's a bit of... Well, that's the other thing, isn't it? He comes across as a bully, but he's actually...
Yeah.
He actually has an ulterior motive, doesn't he?
Yes.
The captain is given proper backstory.
Yeah.
The captain in this is a victim.
Absolutely, he's a victim.
He's a victim of the Queen. Is it Zanzia? Zanzia?
Queen Zanzia, isn't it?
Yeah, he's a victim of her. And,
yeah.
You know, he's everything he does is done pretty much under... duress, and the human part of his brain is trying to work through a revenge.
Absolutely. No, that's a lovely
bit. He's less... Well, he is a tyrant. There's no getting away from that.
Yeah.
But
it's a lovely bit of character development, because although in the TV series, I think I'm right in saying this, he is being controlled by Queen Zansia, but we don't
get... He is from the word go, yeah.
Yeah, but we don't get any of that backstory or understanding.
We don't get any of it.
No.
So he has, you know, he's about to go out in a blaze of glory, and she offers him a lifeline.
Yeah.
Carry on, because she needs his engineering prowess to do what she wants to do.
Yes.
And so he's given this sort of cybernetic add-on to the human remains.
Yeah.
And we go from there, really, because visually he was very striking on the television. And
oh yeah.
Actor called Bruce Purchase. Yeah. He wouldn't have been a Welshman, would he?
I don't know.
I just looked him up. He was born in New Zealand.
Oh, New Zealand, right.
He might have been Welsh. He was so good at shouting.
Oh. Welsh people can shout very well.
They can shout sonic, you know, in a sonorous way, I'm sure.
Yes.
They can.
One of the fabulous Welsh voices, of course, who was in... isn't it terrible? His name has slipped. He died last year as well, and I so admire him. He was in The Brain of Morbius and several...
I know who you mean, Philip Maddock.
What a fabulous voice.
He was Life and Times of David Lloyd George.
He did. And he played it superbly. He was... he's a fabulous... and do you know, that man got slipping off on a tangent again here.
Yeah.
But I did meet him... at a Doctor Who convention a few years back, and he's passed away now, he could speak, I'm sure he says something like 12 languages or something.
Really?
And wherever he would go in the world, like he'd just come back then from, I think it might have been Brazil, but he actually went out with some tribes there, and he learnt their language as a mark of respect, and he said he's always found in his life, even if you can only learn a little, learn people's language when you go there, and you'll be treated much more welcomingly with a great deal of respect. And he said that's what he's always done. But anyway, sorry about that. That's fine.
It's good to remember people and to acknowledge their contribution.
Yes, yeah.
To Doctor Who and the wider universe. So that's all good. Bruce Purchase apparently came from New Zealand.
Oh.
And he was a very memorable villain on the telly, wasn't he? Because he actually features briefly when Tom Baker regenerates in Legopolis. He's one of the people who says Doctor to him.
Is he?
As his life flashes past him.
That's interesting.
I think the Black Guardian's involved in that sequence as well, and Davros definitely is. But you know, the end, but the moment's been prepared for.
Yes.
Now people come and see, and the captain's in that sequence.
Good gosh, I didn't realise that. That's
absolutely. So he was, you know, he did make an impression, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes,
it's important in the Tom Baker era.
Well, I think, you know, in this story, he's the driving force going through that. I mean, we know that, you know, the backstory reveals that, of course, he is being controlled by Queen Zansia, but he is the driving force in the story, that his lines, his dialogue, and I think James Goss really captures the spirit of him there. Some of the lines he comes out with are, you know, a real great one-liners, I think, throughout it. And there is sneaking through it. I think this is a mark of, you know, he's a very good writer doing this. He sneaks in little references. You know, when he's being burnt, or when things are going wrong, when he's striking things, the sympathy starts to develop a little before. You're not suddenly given a revelation of, oh my gosh, he's actually a person controlled by Queen Zansia, as you are in the TV series. You're building up this feeling, you know. Like I said, with that...
Well, yes, we said he was a victim.
Exactly. And you're starting to get that feeling quite soon. It's a nice build-up to it, yeah. So I love that. What about... we're going over to the domestic parts again, but
right.
You mentioned to me privately one of the things which you were really enthused about, which were the mourners, and I agree with you. What would you like to say about those, David?
Well, I enjoyed the fact they were called mentiads on the television.
Sorry.
But they changed them to mourners.
Yeah.
And they carry the guilt of every planet that their planet is eaten. So Zanak sort of materializes around other planets.
Yeah.
And mines them.
Yes.
And although the Age of Prosperities that are declared are a show of wealth and success, there is a payoff for that wealth, and it's the fact that this small group of people, these empathetic people who are born a handful in a generation, have to carry the guilt of what's happening. They see through what is happening, what Zanek is actually doing to neighboring worlds, and it's all I don't know, I just liked the characters.
I thought
they were rather good. I thought that was a rather good sort of revelation.
Yeah, I thought so too. It's quite a deep and quite a touching philosophical concept, I think, isn't it? Because it's got the religious overtone.
Well, yes, absolutely. It's guilt. It's got a lot of guilt, but it's also, I don't know, I think it also makes the point that for one individual to prosper, another must suffer.
Oh, right.
As well. I don't know.
I think
there are a lot of things in this country for sale that are made in China.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think we have to face facts that the reason that happens, and the reason is people aren't prepared to pay the prices that they would need to pay if those workers weren't being underpaid.
Yes. Yeah.
So I get, in my own small way, I get a sense of guilt.
Yeah.
Not that I shop at Poundland particularly, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You only get economically, you only get more than your fair share if somebody else is getting less.
Yes, yeah.
So it's a total payoff, and I think that's what these characters bring home, and I rather liked them.
Yes.
I thought they were a lot better than they were on the telly.
Yes. Oh, yes.
You've got all this backstory with them. And being a mourner is seen as a disease, and Grandfather Balaton, he has been told that these people and the guards shoot them on sight.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we're possibly, because they don't like what they stand for. I don't know, but
well, it's quite satirical, isn't it? I think it's quite satirical, as you've been pointing out, of the world that we live in, that people. Well,
I think effectively slavery's come back.
Yeah.
Because for somebody to prosper, someone else has to suffer.
Yes, yeah.
But yes,
yeah.
I don't want to go off on a tangent again. But,
well, I mean, it is a
subject.
They
were given a lot more backstory and credibility than they had on the telly, and I thought that was very welcome.
Yes, it certainly was welcome, I did like that. I just felt, being a Target fan as well, I just felt that the I don't know, did it really deserve sort of four discs worth of all this this domestic stuff, this backstory with the family? Could it have been achieved?
I don't think every page is full of it, is it?
No.
I think in his enthusiasm to produce the novel that Douglas Adams would have produced, and I think one of the criticisms often levelled at Douglas Adams was he's quite scatological in the way he plotted things. And only City of Death holds together well as a plot because he didn't have any time to rewrite it.
I think
in his enthusiasm
yeah.
to include everything, he's produced a book which bears no relation to a traditional Target novel.
Yes, yeah, which is a great change, you know, and it's I do think though that when we are back in with the main characters, the depth with which he adds to these guys, as you mentioned with K-9 and his thought processes.
Oh, I love
K-9. Yeah,
he was
great. Yeah, and I thought, you know, I don't know if it's the way John Calshaw does him so convincingly, but there are times, and I might have said this before, David, where I completely forget it's John Calshaw doing it. It seems to be Tom. He seems to really embody that. It's not a copy of Tom. He knows the way of Tom's character of the Doctor, I feel, it comes across. Am I gushing too much? Or do you...
It's okay to gush, it's fine. I agree with you. He could read the phone book in that voice.
Absolutely. And Tom Baker has done, hasn't he? He
did the talking. He did something where you could compose a message.
That's right.
And you could send it to someone.
That's right.
Would be Tom Baker's recorded voice chopped up and reassembled.
That's
right. This was years ago. This was over a decade ago.
It was. But there's a lovely story with that, with when he did that.
I think I know what's coming. Yes, tell it.
With Richard Dawkins?
Yes,
of course. Richard Dawkins, when this happened, and of course, whenever anybody sent a sort of text message via BT to the home phone, it came out in the voice of Tom Baker, who'd recorded this. And of course, Richard Dawkins decided to he decided to send Lala Ward, his wife, messages saying, "I love you so much, Lala," and so forth, constantly. But of course, they were coming through in Tom Baker's voice, which he was incredibly irritated by, apparently.
Yes, and now they've split up. So there you go.
Have they?
Well, no, they have. They're either divorced or getting divorced. So he might have thought it was a laugh at the time, but I don't know. I did hear that they were separated.
Oh my gosh!
Which is quite an odd time, really, because neither of them are spring chickens. No. But there you go. We know, Dan, who we mustn't.
That's really sad. I wasn't aware of that.
I'm sure I'm right.
I wish them both, you know, happiness in the future. I'm sorry to hear that.
No, you're absolutely right, because that story was told at the BFI event to Mark Tom Baker's doctor a few years back in 2013, the 50th anniversary year.
Right.
All of his naughtiness using the Tom Baker messaging service came out. And it is funny.
It is funny, yeah, it is. It's just so funny, you can imagine, because she's, even to this day, I don't think Lala can bear to talk about Tom, can she? She's quite...
I've got no idea. They seem to be on Big Finish together, but whether they occupy the same space, I don't know. I would love to know if they recorded together, but you can do so much with audio.
Yes, oh, that's interesting. We've got to find that one out, haven't we? And on the subject of audio trickery and production values, I kept thinking of you, David, because I know you're a stickler for production values. In listening to the audio, I think it's probably... You're going to correct me now. I think it's one of the best recorded and levelled, if you like, if that's the expression to use, of the BBC range. Do you think so?
I certainly think that the soundscape, for want of a better word, there's nothing that sort of sticks out as being instantly incongruous or annoying,
which is
good. And if that's the case, then whoever created that soundscape did it well.
Yes.
Because we always alight on some hideous sound effect in the Target novels, be it a tricycle chase or a tire leaving the mud that sounds like a racing car going around Brands Hatch.
Yes.
That sharp corner. We always do. There wasn't any of that in this one. It was quite proportionate to the action. It was more, I suppose, the whole tone of it. Now, we haven't said this yet, but we have sort of hinted at it.
Yeah.
But the whole tone of everything about this disc and this book was that it was, patently, it was for adults.
Yes.
It didn't need the gimmickry because it had, well, I suppose somebody doing a Tom Baker impression could be counted as a gimmick, but it wasn't because it was a performance. Oh,
absolutely, yes.
And it didn't have all of that really in-your-face noise coming, which I, as an adult, find quite unnecessary.
Yes.
Because I'm listening to words and my mind fills in the gaps, you know, about what's being described.
Well, I mean, absolutely, I agree with you. I think this, not only was it squarely aimed at adults, but I think it was squarely aimed at us as adults, Doctor Who fans.
I wonder how old James Goss is and whether he's our generation or whether he's the generation before.
That's interesting.
I truly don't know, but he made one reference in the book which I thought was rather good. I can't really say it without giving away one of the best jokes. Well, according to the internet, James Goss was born in 1974.
Well,
he is broadly our age, but he's a little bit younger.
Yeah, just a bit. But he could certainly have watched, well, it's very likely, in fact, he would have watched The Pirate Planet. When was that, 79?
78.
That's...
So his, to him, The Pirate Planet would have occurred at the age at which I was watching, say, The Sea Devils or...
Same with me.
Something along those lines.
Yes, yeah, so...
It's just that gap in the ages, isn't it?
That's
but he made a reference to a particular cartoon character. I don't know if you picked it up, because he didn't name the character, but a particularly annoying cartoon character that he's obviously wanted to say something about for years.
Yes.
And I think in those words that he said, I think he very much was the voice of our generation, who also disliked that cartoon character with a passion.
Yes.
For what it was responsible for. And I can't, you know, say any more without giving the whole gag away, which I'm not going to do.
No.
But I had to congratulate the man on Twitter for speaking up for the frustrations of people like me who had been utterly, infuriated by that character.
this has gone back a long way, isn't it, this kind of hatred?
So if you look through my tweets, you'll find who it is if you didn't spot it in the original audio. And I thought he did. You've hit the nail on the head. He didn't only write it for adults.
Yeah.
He wrote it for us.
Yeah. And
it was really nice of him.
Really nice of him, and I really appreciate it, because you did say to me when you were listening to it, as we said, or you listened to it first, and you said about the little references and things which are going to be put in, which we're going to pick up on and love, and it's full of them, isn't it? It's full of them.
It's full of them. The idea that you couldn't get Romana's full name on a Starbucks cup. That was a very contemporary reference that got in.
It was. But we also, of course, have the ones we have Ladybird books mentioned and so forth. And this is a bit of a first, because I believe, would he have written this before those new wave of Ladybird pastiches came out?
Oh, Five Go to Brexit Island or something.
You've got
it's the hipster.
Mindfulness and...
You've got the hipster.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. The father... The mother,
all those. They sort of came out for Christmas, didn't they?
They did. Yeah,
as well as some sort of Enid Blyton pastiches about the famous five who did inappropriate things.
Right, I loved the comic strip version of the famous five many years ago as well. Though, of course, remember the comic strip version with.
What was it in Lookin'?
No, oh, sorry, I meant the comic
strip.
Oh,
no, sorry, the comic strip. You mean Adrian...
Adrian Edmondson and Dawn French.
And Dawn French, yes. And Jennifer Saunders, the comic strip. The Five Go Mad in Dorset.
That's it, yes, yeah. Yeah. So I'm guessing it's within that...
must have been one of the very first things transmitted on Channel 4.
I think it was.
Mad in Dorset.
I think it was. And it was so... I watched it last year or something again. I came across
really,
it somewhere.
Really?
And it's still... And I won't say this about a lot of the comic strip ones because I watched them, because some of them have dated terribly and they're not that funny. But that one was very, very good indeed, I thought.
Well, I think because it was already a send-up of a bygone age...
Yes, yes.
So I think that gave it an advantage.
Yes.
They did two, didn't they? They did two five, famous five.
They did.
Ones, didn't they?
They yeah. did, yes, yeah. Can you see, this is, now this is interesting, David, because James Goss has brought this book out, which we are talking about. It's about Doctor Who that we love. It's about Tom Baker, who we love. It's about actors playing it and recording it, who we love. And it's... also about authors from a different age that we love, and it's also he's sending us off on a reminiscence, a sort of reverie.
I know what you're saying. Reason we like cover versions of things, or the reason people release cover versions of songs, is because they hope to connect with the people who love the original.
Yes,
the closest they can make it to the original, the more they seem to sell.
Yeah, that's right. That's interesting, isn't it?
I always think, he's sort of done a cover version of a Douglas Adams piece here, and we just love it by proxy, because it's Douglas Adams talking to us again from beyond the grave. And
That's a
Douglas
lovely...
Adams only lived to be 49.
Oh, I know. It's an absolute tragedy. It's an absolute...
There's someone who's going to be 49 next week.
Oh, of course.
I think he died on a running machine, didn't he?
It
shows exercise isn't good for you anyway.
He did die on a running machine when he was 49, in the gym in California he was in, I think...
I've got no idea, but he certainly left us too soon. It would have been lovely had he have, got to give voice to all of his ideas that were obviously going on in his head.
Absolutely,
you know, he could have written this himself, but we've got something close.
Yeah, we've got something close.
You're right. He did die in California.
Yeah. Very sad. I think he got the exercise and running bug quite late in life, and I think he was in his 40s and he realized that actually this is fabulous, I feel great doing this, and it makes me feel happy, and he did, but unfortunately his poor heart gave way with that one. It's a real pity,
isn't it? I mean he could have produced so much more work. He was so active and having all these ideas
I find with
Doctor Who family when he went.
Yeah, well,
to the Telefantasy family as well.
Yeah. Well, can you imagine Douglas Adams now with the resurgence of Doctor Who?
Yes, he would have written a cracker, wouldn't he?
He would have. There
was a story not so long ago when the TARDIS morphed into a lady from Lancashire, from Coronation Street.
And it was fabulous.
And you could almost see it being in the Douglas Adams mould, story.
That was Neil Gaiman.
Do you know, I was thinking, because I can't even remember what that episode was called.
The Doctor's Wife.
Right.
Neil Gaiman.
So much a pastiche of an Adams... Yeah, story, wasn't it?
It was.
What hit me about it anyway when I saw it.
It's such a beautiful story, wasn't it? It was. I'm gonna go on record as saying I actually cried during that one. It was so touching and so beautifully done, and it captured the essence of the Doctor and the TARDIS and what they do in the world. So, you know, you mentioned earlier about that storyline, which is the stranger who comes and does good, you said?
Yes, it's a bit like the Lone Ranger, the chap who comes comes into town,
yes,
cleans everything up, leaves again.
Yeah.
And you don't know anything about him except he was a thoroughly good bloke.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And
you know, that's sort of the New Testament in a nutshell. So
yes,
that's there are so few storylines out there.
Yes, yeah. Well,
The benign stranger. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's something, you know, is it the Kurosawa film, The Seven Samurai?
Yeah. Yeah.
Idea that there are people with such a code of honor that they'll come and they'll defend strangers for a bowl of rice a day. And of course, that morphed, just saying what we were saying about storylines reinventing, that morphed into the Magnificent Seven.
Yes, it did.
The seven strangers who go to protect, you know, the Western outpost from, I think in the original it was Mexican bandits.
Yes.
You know, that's exactly the same plot, and I think, yes, you know, Doctor Who in a nutshell is the benign stranger who sorts things out and leaves again.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's, you know, it's captured beautifully in the, and, you know, Douglas Adams, and what James Goss has captured as well, some of the Douglas Adams-like lines, the Douglas Adam-esque lines, I thought they were fabulous. There's the one where... you know, I think it may be around disc 8 or something like that, when the captain is punching the computers or the machine.
That's right.
Yes, yeah. In anger. And I think the chapter ends with him, he's smoking and trapped in it. And I don't know if it's fibbly, but somebody says, because the captain is made up of part machine and part flesh, and the flesh is smoking. And it ends with saying... he looked up at the massive figure of the captain and said, there was so much of him, and then there was so little of him.
Right.
That's really a sort of Adam-esque type line, isn't it? Of the contradiction there between... Because, of course, he's still a huge character, but he's so much robot, there's very little left of him in it, isn't it?
Which, there was a bit towards the end where the captain roars, I shall have my... revenge, and the Queen mistakenly says, indeed you shall, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
The captain thinks that wasn't quite what I meant. Because he needs to take revenge on her.
That's great, isn't it? That's great, isn't it? Well, not only have we got that nostalgia element and those things put in there, but there is a glut of Doctor Who references there just for us fans. And
the framing of the book as well.
Yeah.
You know, you get a mystery character.
Yeah.
I think we all know who the mystery character is. And at the end, the mystery character goes into some sort of garden.
Yes.
Doesn't he? And he thinks, I'll get the Doctor to do my bidding for me.
Yes.
Etc.
Yes.
And because it must be very hard for James Goss, because he's got the top and tail of this novel.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
should be part two of a six-part sort of volume of novels, shouldn't it?
So, of the Key to Time sequence, yeah.
Yeah, the Key to Time. So he has to make it a self-contained novel and keep it in context.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a nice little add-on after all the action's finished, really, isn't it?
To go back and have a look at that mystery character.
Yeah.
And also, I think there's a bit at the beginning as well, isn't there? Because he has to basically say what's happened in Rebos Operation very, very concisely.
Yes, yeah.
So he can get on with that, can't he?
He does that well, I think.
So he does, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Good.
And just going back as well to the, you know, you were mentioning about the Neil Gaiman story of the TARDIS morphing.
Oh, yes, it was.
Of course, there's quite a big section about the TARDIS and her personalities, isn't there? Do you remember the
Yes.
And they
talked about absolutely true, because it was purely a sort of a new Who sequence. There's a sequence which should be the cliffhanger to episode 3.
Yeah.
Where very consciously the actual cliffhanger from the television, the Doctor thinks something to the effect of, oh, if only I had that, I could have resolved this far more simply. But he hasn't got what he had on telly, and he falls down into this black hole.
Yeah.
And there's a very sort of new Who-esque sequence in which the TARDIS comes and gets him, yeah, almost destroying itself in the process.
Yes, that's right.
Ravana, yeah, has to throw aside the manuals and actually run the machine intuitively.
Yes.
And because the whole idea is the machine's symbiotic, and
yeah,
and the doctor controls it.
Yes, it's so good, isn't it? And it talks about the different types of TARDISes, isn't it? Like I say, isn't there? There's a very funny bit, and I didn't write it down, about there's a war TARDIS, isn't there? Or there's one where they go to the wars where there's no door on because they don't want to get out and put themselves in danger. And there's all,
yeah,
so,
yeah.
It's a great, you know, it's certainly a work of love, isn't it?
It is. It's a labour of love.
Labour of love.
To sample the story.
Yes.
And yeah, it's certainly a fusion of the Douglas Adams style and some things that people new to Doctor Who would resonate with relative newcomers to Doctor Who, and plenty that would please the old guard like you and I.
Yes, yes,
very
absolutely
much so.
And Romana is characterised beautifully as well.
She is.
I think there's lovely sequences with Romana and the sort of the play between them, the sort of, how would you describe that? There's a bit of enviousness. Yes, yeah, the interplay.
Well, she is set up as a character without any life experience whatsoever.
Yeah.
So she is sort of the diametric opposite of the Doctor, who has been there, done that, got the T-shirt in just about every situation. And she tries to challenge his authority for a proportion of the book, but she sort of grows. It's a sort of a rites of passage now, this adventure,
yeah,
for Romana, when she learns to trust her instincts and be a little bit less regimented and a bit more free thinking. So yeah, she is, I don't know, she's like an apprentice to the Doctor, isn't she?
Yes,
by,
yeah,
the end of the book she mellows. I mean, she as I say, a lot of her attitudes at the beginning of the book are based on being unaware of how much she has to learn, and as, yeah, she learns a bit more, she grows as a character.
Yes.
And it's all rather lovely the way it's played out within the book.
It is. It's very daintily and comically done, and it's quite subtle, I felt, and nice little.
Certainly not the same person that she was at the start of the book by the time it ends.
No.
And key to that is, as I say, you know, the TARDIS rescue that she performs at the end of what would be episode 3 on the telly.
Yes.
Because that's, yeah, a very, very long sequence, the fall through the planet. It's
very long.
A huge piece of writing.
I will.
But it's very engaging writing as
well. It is engaging writing, yeah.
Really, you sort of know how it's going to end. It's going to end in rescue.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But
it's certainly rescue of New Who style, as you mentioned, isn't it? It's, you know, I imagine, you know, of the time. I mean, this is the beauty of it. He does collapse time with this story by bringing together 1970s Tom Baker Who with New Who and Douglas Adams. You know, there's an amalgamation in there which works really, really well, I think, apart from that, the domestic things. For me, I felt that was, I think you too as well.
I don't think that's unfair.
Right.
But yeah, I do think, I mean, another, we should mention him really. Prelix has another. He's another character who has that rites of passage, because he goes from this incapacitated, vulnerable character, and he sort of morphs into an avenging angel, doesn't he? By the time he's leading the charge on the Citadel.
Yes.
And his sister as well, Mueller. She's the better rebel, but.
Yeah.
Keymus is the sort of self-proclaimed rebel leader.
Yes.
There's a funny turnaround in those characters too, but they do become better when they're out of the domestic setting.
They
all
do.
All of the characters do.
Yeah,
I totally agree with you.
Yeah, they do. But so we're coming up to nearing the end of this
review. We're going to have to give a score, aren't we?
Yes.
Maybe. Right, I'm going to have a think now.
Well,
I'll quickly recap. We've said that the book is nostalgic. We like that. We've said that James Goss has done a very thorough job with the book. We've said we adore John Coleshaw's reading of the book.
Yeah.
We've said that we enjoyed strong character moments for several characters, including K-9.
Yeah.
Mr. Fibulae, we liked the captain, we liked all the internal thought processes and the use of the TARDIS. Now, and we said that the sound effects were appropriate and proportionate.
Yes.
I'm just thinking what score I'm going to give this.
Well,
and I think I've got a score coming through, but I'm going to listen to your score first.
Well, the more you... I actually entered into starting the talk today, the review. In my head, I was going to give it an 8 because I thought it's a great thing. But that domestic part was dull and lifeless, I felt, and it was putting me off. So I thought I will give it an 8 because I love the rest. But I realise the more we've talked about it, the more, because it is a big, long listen to.
It's a commitment.
It is. That's a nice way, but it is a commitment. It's brought back the memories of the whole experience of listening to it. And actually, it's been a great deal of fun. So I'm going to knock it up to a 9 because...
A 9?
Yeah. There's too much good stuff in there to miss, really. And
it's almost 1 point a disc. You do realise that?
It is, isn't it? I don't know...
Well, I was going to say, I mean, for much the same reason, I had in mind an 8.5.
Ah.
But I can't give a lower score than you because that just doesn't happen in these discussions. So I think I'm going to upgrade to a 9 as well.
Oh, wow.
Because as we've said, you know, the more we've discussed it, the more we've realised that there is gold in their hills.
Yeah.
We dug for it. We found it.
Yeah.
Now we're celebrating what has been achieved with the audio, and it is a beautiful piece of merchandise.
Oh, it is! It
really is. I'm so glad, you know, we've had the chance to review it and listen to it and enjoy it. So yes, I'm going with a 9.
Oh well, that's really great actually, because for both of us to give such a high score as this, and something they could have just left it, couldn't they? They could have just left it, you know, and. But this has been resurrected and brought back to life.
Lovingly,
yes, yes.
Great and, love and affection.
And you know, some of the things you mentioned in here, I realised that I missed, and it sounded so good when you were saying them. I thought, well, how did I miss that? And I think because it is a big commitment.
It is a big task.
Yeah.
It's very easy to become detached from the less engaging parts of the audio and to become totally caught up, because by the end I couldn't get enough of it.
No.
It was rather sad when it ended, actually.
Yes, because you'd given me fair warning as well to say the pace really starts to pick up and it gets bigger and
picked up. It became a lot more urgent.
Yeah. So 9 out of... Well, do you know, I want to say thank you so much to BBC Audio and Penguin Random House for giving us review copies of this.
Yes.
And they have actually sent an extra copy as a prize for somebody. So you can see...
I know what's coming now.
You know what's going now, David. I'm landing this on you because this isn't planned, David, is it? Because you've come up with such great questions in the past, you know, is... I think I don't know if we're allowed to say, but yeah, I think it's gone now. Yeah, the Blenovich limitation effect one you came up with for
the Blenovich limitation effect.
That was a good one. That was.
Did someone get that? Has somebody won?
Well, do you know what? No, they didn't. they didn't. So, but I don't think it was because your question was too difficult. I don't know why. Nobody wrote in. So that one is still up for grabs. But they I'm not going to give it to somebody now because they...
Because we've said the answer.
But if they...
Right, best of 3 then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead. Okay.
Right. I've said that already, so we can't say that. The question I'm going to set is, I want to know the name of the actor... who played Mr. Fibulae on the television. So that's the name of the actor who played Mr. Fibulae on the television.
That's a great question,
and I
dear.
Think that the listeners will be able to recall that and tweet you the answer and win the audio. And I can absolutely assure them that it is well worth having.
Oh, well, yeah, because it's a substantial set, this, isn't it? This isn't this isn't £20. This is quite a bit sum of money, I think, isn't it?
And, this is a thing of beauty.
Yes, absolutely, and that's a great question. And of course, just need to tweet, which is Dr. Who on Target, or email Doctor Who, which is DROCT, or Doctor Who on Target at gmail.com. It's either of those, and I'd love someone to win this. Because I'm sure you want to read out who's won it, David, isn't it? And
so we have to be happy to.
Yeah, because that was a real pity the Day of the Daleks one didn't go, because that was a lovely set, that one.
That was a thing of beauty as well, yeah.
Absolutely. And so we've done it. I really enjoyed doing this review today. I hope the listeners have as well. Now, David, can you tell us, you mentioned to me, I wasn't aware of this, there's a couple of beauties coming up. I think you did mention one earlier.
Well, yes, Genesis of the Daleks is scheduled for release. There's a couple of others that I can't recall now. That's... Galaxy 4 is one of them.
Right, right.
Galaxy 4 is coming. There are quite a few coming. If I could get onto Amazon quickly enough, I could tell you what some of the other ones might be. But we know Galaxy 4. I think The Rescue is one of them.
Oh,
which is the Ian Marter novel. I think it was his last novel.
Oh,
actually.
Is that an Ian Marter one?
The Rescue. Oh, no, sorry. That's the I'm talking rubbish. That's sadly, that's the one he was writing when he died.
Oh,
I think. Let's have a look. We've got we haven't. That's not new. Oh, gosh, you've really put me on the spot.
Don't worry.
But I know some of the ones I just said were the truth. We've got Planet of Giants coming.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And we've got Delta and the Bannerman.
Oh.
And Galaxy 4, as I said.
Yeah.
Let's have a look if there are any narrators listed. Oh, we've got The Mind of Evil.
Oh,
I bet that would be Richard Franklin.
Is that confirmed or are we not?
Yes. It seems to be confirmed. So far we've got the Planet of Giants, the Mind of Evil, Delta and the Bannerman, and Galaxy 4 that I'm seeing.
Right. That's great.
So that's a few to get on with, isn't it?
Well, we'll certainly be reviewing those, but I'm wondering now which one we're going to do next, because
You tell me. It doesn't seem a lot of point doing 4 to Doomsday at this point, does it?
No.
It's now out.
No, and I think we've haven't kept up with the schedule, and this is all entirely my fault, but I'm looking at my bookshelf, obviously, and staring out is a beautiful, moody, mist-covered Tom Baker with a lighthouse in the background.
Oh, The Horror of Fang Rock.
Do you fancy that one?
Oh, yes, we'll do that one next.
Brilliant. Read by Louise Jameson, it says on
here. Yes, indeed, it is.
We've got to do it, haven't we? That's one of my...
I think we've got to do that one, yeah.
Definitely. Should we go for that one next, then?
Yes, we'll crack on with that one and record it.
And if anybody wants to tweet or email their thoughts of what they think of The Horror of Fang Rock, please do, again, at doctorwhoontarget@gmail. And we'll read them out, David, don't we?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that would be great. And we've thought, with the new season of Doctor Who coming up, although we usually review the Target books, we are playing with the idea, I think, of reviewing the stories as they come out. What do you think, David?
I think that would be a good idea.
Right, and we'll try to bring those
out. We can try and record those when they're fresh in our minds.
Yeah.
And then release them as sort of mini specials for the regular, in between the regular Target reviews, can't we?
Absolutely. Now, I think that would be. I'd love to do that, and I'm going to put you on the spot. But you are about to do something in the city of London.
Am I? Soon, right.
Which you've been training very, very hard for, and has been a big ambition for you. Do you want to tell people what you're going to do?
Yes, I'm going to run the London Marathon.
Oh, wow, that's going to be so good. And are you doing
say I'm going to run it. As things stand, I'm going to run it. But, you know, if I pick up an injury, I won't be able to, and I'll have to defer. But my intention is to run the London Marathon.
And it's going, your training schedule is going really well today, isn't it?
It's been, yes, it's been met, I think is the right word for that. It's a big commitment running a marathon. I won't pretend it isn't. You have to get a lot of miles in your legs before you take it on. But I'm where I want to be at this time. I've got, where are we? A little over 4 weeks to go now, so I've got sort of 37 miles a week, weeks coming up. So this is my first 37 miler this week. I don't mean in one go. I mean over the course of the week. But, yes. And then the next week starts with a very long run of between 20 to 22 miles.
Oh my
so
gosh,
that takes a lot of my time.
Yeah.
If I'm not listening to Target novels, I'm invariably out running somewhere.
Yeah, well, you've actually recorded this today after doing a half marathon.
Just did a half marathon today.
In your best time, I believe, isn't it?
Yes, it was a personal best today.
So you bravely dragged yourself to the microphone and carried on doing...
Oh, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, David. The same here, pleasure to talk to you too. And I hope it's a pleasure for everybody to listen to us rabbit on about Doctor Who. As I say, and I think that's wrapping it up for this week, really. But please send your thoughts or anything, or any requests, I suppose. You could send, just email us, just do something like that. And I'll just say thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next time you won't see you, but we'll hear next time you hear us reviewing The Horror of Fang Rock. Please tweet us at Doctor Who on Target. That's DR Who on Target. Or email us at DoctorWhoOnTarget@gmail.com. That's the end of this episode, and I would like to thank BBC Audio and Penguin Random House for kindly supplying us with preview copies, and to Smerin's Antisocial Club for the use of their version of the Doctor Who theme tune. The biggest thank you goes to you, our listeners.